Artificial intelligence is no longer restricted to science fiction, for sure. Today it's all over, and big tech companies like Amazon, Facebook, Google are using it in a lot of different ways. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Great to have back Jesse LeGrew. He's a technical team lead within the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, or DOIT. And Jesse, maybe give us a little lesson on AI and machine learning. And of course, he'll also help you with your tech problems. So I hope you'll join in. Maybe your computer's giving you some problems. What about your smartphone? What do you think about AI? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Jesse LeGrew, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
How do you define artificial intelligence? Let's start with the basic.
And generally, it's when you think of, or at least most people think of intelligence, it's human intelligence. And so being able to replicate in kind of a non-biological form. And so artificial intelligence in this case is really being able to use a computer to be an analog for what normally we consider only a human being capable of doing, at least higher levels of reasoning, pattern recognition, and a lot of the things that we don't think about in a day-to-day basis, but that in some ways are unique to us or to other living organisms.
So I think the history of this is a little interesting, too. I mean, it's more than 60 years old, and it's advanced a lot in the last 60 years, probably a lot in the last maybe 20 years.
Yeah, and it's just like many things. We see a lot in science fiction, even in science fiction that's been around for over 100 years, and ideas that people have talked about or dreamed about. And a lot of times there's just a barrier at, you know, what people have access to now to actually make some of these things a reality. We have more powerful computing power. We have a lot of things that just weren't there in the past. And, you know, having a computer or something else being able to make a decision is something based on different kinds of input is something that's been around for quite a while.
Yeah.
And that's something even when thinking about machine learning, you know, what does that really mean? And how do we... how does that really work functionally? Because we have programmers that are effectively trying to make computers make decisions based upon inputs. And in this case, the computer is able to learn based on what they call like supervision or being to learn all by itself. Kind of like if you were a child, you know, you have a variety of things that you're taking in with the world and you're developing your own intelligence, your own reactions to stimulus over time. Most of that supervised, however, by a parent, by your community, and by others that you're interacting with. And it's similar for artificial intelligence or machine learning as well, because you can have a variety of ways that a machine can learn, and all of these inputs and all of this coaching can impact what happens in the end.
Well, it's really interesting, and I'll tell a story that I think I've told before on the air, but I was in... at the Space Center in Florida, and my daughter is a big manatee fan, and so we're there, and I go out, ask Siri, I say, Siri, can you tell us where we could see some manatees in the wild around here? And Siri says, well, go to, told us a place to go, and we went, and there was a manatee. I mean, that's artificial intelligence, right, that we're talking about here?
And it definitely can be. And that's where, you know, humans create a structure around it. And especially with machine learning right now and where it's becoming a big driver for business applications and other applications is we have a lot of data out there we just don't know what to do with or we don't know how to sort it effectively. We're used to the data that we take in on a day-to-day basis as humans, but when you think about all this data we're collecting for a variety of things, it's difficult for us to consume it to do something with. And when you think about being able to find, I would like to find a certain animal kind of close to where I am so I don't have to travel too far, computers are able to take various sources of data and actually combine it in a way that's meaningful to you. So it didn't tell you, hey, there's a manatee 2,000 miles away. it told you something relatively close based upon where you were and was able to give you that information. But it's coming from a variety of data sources in order to give you that one piece of data.
The amount of power, I'm trying to imagine the number of computers that have to be involved in something. How does it work with them?
That's a great question. I probably can't go into too much depth
right.
in. Although, thinking about when you have a large database of data, it's a lot of information, and it's difficult to pull out one piece and make a decision. And this was something when they looked at, and which really, I think people would argue this wasn't truly artificial intelligence since it was highly supervised and highly coordinated training for the computer, but they had Garry Kasparov and playing Deep Blue in the game of chess. And there's a lot of data outside of the decision-making and trying to calculate all these different moves. The biggest thing that was a barrier was pattern recognition, being able to take a look at a picture and make a decision based upon certain things that you see, to kind of take a leap from going towards a very linear path to actually being able to take certain shortcuts. And it's those shortcuts that make all the difference, that mean you could potentially use a less powerful computer and still the same data source to actually make things, make decisions more effectively, make them more efficiently. And I think that's one of the biggest things that assists with that. Because otherwise, if you're just trying to search for, and they talk about this with quantum computing too, if you're searching for a person in a building and there are 1,000 rooms, how we'd normally search for something as a person, we'd go room by room. You just keep on going until you find somebody. But a quantum computer, in theory, could actually put somebody in every room all at the same time, and you find out where this individual is instantaneously. And that's one of the examples that they had from probably 10 or 15 years ago that I had read in a magazine. But there's different ways to kind of shortcut that, and the pattern recognition is a huge portion. But how you teach that is a little bit different, and that's where that machine learning and how to actually develop that intelligence and that decision making over time, that also matters.
It's interesting. Mark in Franklin has something I think that relates to this. Let's go there. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Within the last couple of months, there was an article, at least in a lot of the technical journals that I read, about one of the universities developing artificial intelligence. And they had a machine that they were trying to develop artificial intelligence on. The machine developed its own language that was unreadable to its human friends, I guess. And they were afraid that it would communicate with another machine that way and not know what the machines were saying, so they shut it off. I guess I was looking for a comment on that, if you've heard about that. I believe it was MIT.
Yeah, and it's one of those many examples, and one of those examples I think that everyone does think about AI, and there's a difference of understanding of really this computer system or these computer systems that develop their own intelligence. And this is one of those examples where we don't understand it and we're terrified of it and we want to turn it off. There could have been an opportunity to potentially learn, and there might be something we actually learn in the future. And it's just one of those things at the moment we just don't understand, because we don't know if there's anything nefarious. We don't know if it was also, benevolent and like, hey, this is the answer to everything. If you just pay attention and read it, you're gonna understand. You're gonna have a higher understanding. But we just don't know. And I think that's one of the things with anything that we face in our day to day. The unknown is terrifying. Artificial intelligence gives us different things to think about, and it's also really challenging from an understanding point to actually understand kind of what's going on. And, some of that can be answered by psychology. Some of that can be answered by computer scientists. But it's one of those very interesting problems. And part of me, I think about the language and it sounds kind of neat. And like, why would it create its own language? Is, what's the significance behind it outside of being able to communicate and potentially communicate effectively? Is there some, efficiency? We have a lot of different languages. each with their own idiosyncrasies and probably their own benefits. There's some things in one language that don't exist in another, so communication's different. What's this, you know, thing we're missing from this language? So it brings up a lot of interesting questions, but I think it's that other thing of we just don't know what's going to happen. We can't predict the future. There's a limit to our control. And when we do have artificial intelligence that is developing itself, and, you know, whether that's consciousness or sentience or anything like that. And, you know, that's a big question, too, with having sentience and, you know, a Turing test and understanding, like, what does this actual intelligence mean that we just don't know? And it's difficult to look at because of everything that we have digitized in our world. And that's another concern right now is really security aspects of artificial intelligence. There's a lot of useful things that we can apply artificial intelligence to, but it also brings up challenges at the same time where artificial intelligence can get around items of security with everything plugged into a worldwide network. What can artificial intelligence affect all at once? When we think about all of our lives, I don't know how easy it would be for me to simply never use a computer for even, let's just say, a month.
Yeah.
Any kind of equipment or anything else that relies on it. So, for example, even, you know, exchanging money. Like, you can have paper money, but if you want to get something from your account, you're going to be interfacing with digital system. But think about just everything we use, and then think about an artificial intelligence that could potentially usurp all these security controls. It gets scary really fast. Like, everything is just going to melt down.
I was... thanks very much, Mark, for calling. Appreciate it. And the men and women who turned off the computer probably had all seen 2001 A Space Odyssey and remembered HAL. And that's something that we're all sort of kind of inoculated into our systems a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the example here was from devising its own language was actually Facebook. So it was a Facebook AI project. And it was from the Facebook AI Research Lab, otherwise known as FAIR, that developed this AI that, you know, basically created its own language. When you think about Facebook, you think about pictures, you think about communication, how many different languages are flowing through it. And that really is the, you know, kind of foundation of machine learning. You give it lots of data. Facebook has lots of data. Mm-hmm. It can help to devise a lot of things based on that data. And it's an interesting output that, you know, it would be interesting to see, like, what does that mean? Like, you went through all these languages and devised a new language. There's something that comes from it. And just scientifically, it's an interesting aspect of, you know, what can come out, things that we just can't do ourselves that a machine can actually help us to accomplish.
You know, you sent me a little piece on IBM's Project Debater. And this is fascinating. Talk about this project and why, and maybe why you think it's important.
Well, and there's a lot of, and this is the, you know, the beauty of IBM Labs that have just done a lot of things, like IBM's Watson's Deep Blue. But it's neat to see this one from, you know, thinking about debate as the idea of putting out ideas and really, in some sense, validating them, finding out what's true, what's not, and being able to use discourse as a way to make a decision. Not only that, because, you know, humans do this very quickly. They do it with their own language. So there's a language aspect to it. There's a data aspect to it. There's a reasoning aspect to it to also understand what is true and not. And, you know, that's one of the things of debate. You want to be correct. But the idea is to actually have a dialogue. So it's not necessarily this is right and wrong, but it's using collective information from both sides to actually achieve something closer to truth. And I know it can be like a win or lose thing, but that's not necessarily where it came from. So it's interesting to have a machine that's able to tap all these data sources to actually have a debate with a human in a human language that the machine also has to understand syntax, and also has to understand a little bit of the nuance of a human language in order to be able to interact. There's just so many different pieces here that do have benefits for, one, ourselves. And this is one of these things we see all the time, and we're probably taking more and more for granted, translation apps. Being able to translate from one language to another. It was one of those things I think we even heard about, and it's probably been written about for decades. But the fact, we actually have that now, and we have it to an extent where you can communicate with somebody in a completely different language pretty effectively. In this case, you're having a machine actually vocalize and actually communicate and take in verbal speech and actually have a conversation, but also being able to take pieces of data to combine that into an argument or into something that people can converse with. So there's a lot of big pieces here. One of the things that seemed overarching as a big benefit, still kind of scary, is there are limits to what we can do and limits to how we can consume data and how we can actually relay that data. With a computer with various numbers of resources is able to take that data, aggregate it, understand it, and communicate it back in a form that we can interact with, but can actually add a voice to a conversation that otherwise might be very difficult to come to. And I think that's one of the challenges that, you know, we have now is, you know, I'm going to look at the data that I'm used to looking to that's going to validate my own view. If you're able to give a very relative, you know, diverse cross-section of data to a machine to help it actually figure things out and to learn and to adapt, you're going to get a different idea. And I think that's one of the benefits that you can kind of see with this is you can give it the data that will actually help to give an informed opinion that can give different perspectives very quickly that may not be possible in other ways, just because, you know, for a variety of things, emotion and a lot of things that we kind of bring into discussions. So there's just a lot of interesting things to think about with this when you think about just language, conversation, being able to take in data sources. There's just so many pieces to this project.
You could take and there are so many issues out there that would be really interesting to have this debater up and working on. Climate change is an example of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting, there always has been, but as, you know, we have more social media, more communication that's easily accessible on a global scale, there are a lot of conversations out there that people, you hear on a day-to-day basis. And it's difficult to sort fact from fiction sometimes. And this could be a good opportunity to help to do that. But the data inputs are the most important part.
Yeah.
And that's where having that supervised learning is crucial. It's just difficult to pick with our own bias.
Yeah.
Because you just never know what's going to be there. And that's even one of the items that came up from the experiments with the chatbot for Microsoft. That said some, you know, not great things on the internet, on Twitter, and a lot of it was based because of the inputs they had from the community, and the community potentially trying to tweak it a little bit to say some not great things. They succeeded, potentially, if that was their goal. But the idea that the input affects the output, and if we're still the individuals giving the input, we're still affecting the output. It's difficult to separate that, and how can you do that in a way that doesn't actually create bias, but still allows for complete objectivity.
Jesse LeGru, our guest today, technical team lead within the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology. We're talking, well, AI or artificial intelligence and machine learning right now with him, but we'll take your questions about other things as well when it comes to your computer or your software. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Dave Poltratz, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at artificial intelligence today and your computer and your software issues that you might have with our guest, Jesse LeGru, technical team lead at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Division of Information Technology. Join in, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call, and we'll take a call now from Sean in Madison. Sean, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Nice to be on the show. I think for every show about hazelnuts, there should be a show about artificial intelligence.
Okay.
I think it'd be really good if you could fill that in. Yeah, I wanted to ask your guest, I think my biggest concern about artificial intelligence and about the growing, the spread of automation is, what is the human factor? I mean, what will, you know, what's the future of work if, you know, computers can be the gatekeeper of who does what work and who's allowed to work and what work will be available for people if everything is automated and self-run is my question.
And that's one of the concerns that everyone has. When do, you know, we become potentially obsolete depending on the job that we have on a day-to-day basis? And I think that's a real concern for a variety of occupations because they will become automated. And I think that the question is still, what are those jobs? I think we have ideas and we could throw them out there. One of the items that still comes up is, you know, the machines themselves, these artificial intelligence that we're creating, they still need direction, they still need guidance, they still need input. And even when looking at computer fields, there are still aspects that need to be human instructed. And in many cases, these artificial intelligences actually need instruction from humans in order to perform certain tasks or to perform them in a way that a human would be able to. Now, that's, I think, still a subset of what we're looking at in terms of automation and what would change. It could open up other opportunities to actually look at different occupations maybe we haven't already. So maybe just shifting from kind of what we're doing now to something else, which, you know, happens over time. And I think that's happened even with other technological advancements over time, that we shift one direction or another. What those, you know, future jobs look like, I'm not sure. I think people have ideas of kind of what they could be. But how artificial intelligence is actually going to shift what we're doing now, so like what occupations go away, is a big question. I think that was something that was even brought up in the medical industry when looking at an oncologist that specifically looks for patterns and pictures to help to diagnose specific ailments. Computers are actually pretty good when trained on how to pick up those patterns and can actually do it better and quicker. Well, then what happens to that occupation? Somebody still needs to teach a machine, so that's one aspect. But it's a big question to find out, you know, what do we do when this happens? And I think there's also the aspect with anything computer-related. You always think about contingency planning. When the computer fails, what do you do? That's still going to be an aspect, so people are still going to need to know how to do these things. The scale could be much different. It could be much smaller. And I think that's one of these things we're going to be seeing more and more. I mean, I haven't seen a fully automated, for example, a fast food restaurant myself, but they're out there. That's something that's going to be potentially more and more prevalent. I think we're still looking to see which way that goes. But it's a real concern. But I think it could open up opportunities to actually focus work in other areas that could also offer a societal benefit or something else that we're currently not focusing on or doing right now.
Yeah, it makes sense. But you think about fast food, what is it? Probably one in every four kids works in there's some fantastic figure about the number of people who actually work in that industry or get their start working in something like fast food. Where do they go then?
Yep, and that was a job that I did for 3.5 years. I worked in fast food for 3.5 years. I worked in a kitchen. I did that. Before that, I was I delivered papers. But even thinking about papers, well, how many people deliver papers? It's, you know, it's on the internet. You can get a subscription. There's still needs for certain types of media, but as technology changes, it changes how we do things and changes the jobs that we have. That's going to happen. I think there's going to be other vocations that probably fill in those gaps. And we're going to see that probably new vocations are created as this is embraced more. But it is going to be, it's going to be a shift, and it's probably not going to be a smooth transition.
Oh. Sean, thanks again for calling. And we'll take your computer questions. We can talk AI, or we can talk just standard computer concerns with our guest, Jesse LeGru. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Dennis in Afton, Minnesota next. Dennis, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi, everybody. Thanks a lot for the opportunity here. Yeah, I had three Hotmail accounts. This is a while ago, after since I went face-to-face here for a time. But Big Red Paragraph came up, and all three accounts were shut down. And I had the library person witness the third account being shut down, and that was the library where I had them set up. And I visited the Attorney General here in Minnesota as well, and they say there's laws that are needed. And, like, for example, who gets the book that's one period away from being done and a guy leaves the surface of the earth? Where do these things go? I'm still on the surface of the earth. Now I really want my accounts back, and I'm wondering what I can do about that. There was an article in one of the papers recently about that occurring, so I know it's an issue at this time.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Jesse, any comments?
And for, at least for Hotmail and a lot of other accounts, they do look to see if an account is stale, so if it hasn't been utilized in a certain amount of time, and they will just by default delete it. They'll delete all the messages. There's no way to get the messages back or the email account as it existed. It potentially could be recreated, and I think, I'm not sure if that's the case with Hotmail. So, for example, if you had an email, you know, whatever the address was, could you recreate the same exact address so you don't have to tell people I have a new address? I think that's service specific. But in this case, if it's not used, they remove it, especially in this case where a lot of these services are free. It doesn't really give the company an incentive to keep them around. And it's probably also one of those items that's actually in the end user license agreement that we click through so quickly that actually states if it's not used in a certain amount of time, we're going to delete it. Now, these are all guesses on my part without actually creating an account and reading through it. But especially with any free service, I kind of assume that any free service could just disappear at any moment in time without my input or anything else. Since I'm not actually... I'm probably agreeing to things where that could be the case. It's also a concern... It's still a concern with paid services. Paid services get removed every now and again if a company goes bankrupt or something else happens. It's a real risk, especially if using it. And, you know, there might not be a whole lot of recourse, especially if it is in that end user license agreement. They delete the account, it goes away, and there's not a whole lot you can do, and there actually might not be a whole lot they can do technologically to get that account back. In many cases, to actually restore accounts, depending on the system, it requires restoring far more to just get that account up and running. It's not as easy as, well, I put it in the trash, I'm just going to take it out. It could be much more involved. And in this case, especially for free accounts, there's no real incentive for, you know, Microsoft or any other company to do that.
So in Dennis's case, he probably has to start new accounts. And probably has lost any information that he had in the old accounts.
Correct. And I took a look at some of the general information, and for most of the accounts, if it's been not used for a certain amount of time, they'll delete it. It's the same thing with any kind of company or university account. There's kind of a standard thing of if you exit in a certain way, the account goes away. So if you're no longer a student, after a certain amount of time, the account gets deleted. That's just how it works.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't, you know, matter in terms of if it's used a lot or not. But in this case, with especially free services, they'll commonly have that. If it's not in use, we want to, you know, open up our resources so we can give it to somebody else. So it really is just a resource cost for them, and they kind of do that math. And when it doesn't happen, it's probably a computer in the background that's just automated to do that.
Yeah.
All it takes is logging in once and sending one email. It resets the clock. And that's, you know, one of the risks. If you want to make sure an account's around for quite some time, you don't use it often, you may have to simply log in every 6 months just to keep it running.
Dennis, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Jeff in Duluth, Minnesota next. Thank you, Jeff, for calling.
Yes, thank you. I'm far from being very knowledgeable about IT, and yet I'm often called on to do IT things because I'm more knowledgeable than anybody else in our organization. But my question is this. I was recently using working with an application, and I hesitate bringing it up, but it might be helpful to name what it is just for the sake of discussion, although I don't want it to be about that particular product. But I was working within Windows on remote desktop connection, and I understand, you know, there's a lot involved in that type of thing. But what I found was it just said it could not connect. And as I did some Google searching and looking around to see what the problem is, I got a lot of responses of it could be this, it could be this, it could be this, try this, try this. If this doesn't work, try this. And it seems to me like artificial intelligence should be able to give an application like that some ability to say, well, at least this is where we got stuck. This is where you should go to try to fix this. Is artificial intelligence being used in applications like that in that way? I guess that.
Yeah, interesting question, Jeff. Thanks for calling. Jesse?
And in terms of end user applications with their own computers, that's been improving over time, where the computer itself can state this is most likely the issue. And I think from an enterprise standpoint or a more global standpoint, there are tools that can help to troubleshoot those specific instances by really, you know, taking in various amounts of data. They still need people to kind of train. This is what abnormal looks like, and this is potentially what it means to help make those decisions. And computers can do a variety of troubleshooting tasks in order to find specific issues. In this case, especially with, you know, remote desktop or any kind of, let's say, internet or network-based troubleshooting, you're always limited based on the environment. So for remote desktop, for example, you have two computers, probably in two different locations. You can troubleshoot to an extent the computer on one end or the computer on the other end, but you also have to be concerned with what's between those two, the internet in this case. And so there are limits in terms of what can be done, but if you take a look at a different system, so if I have data from both computers and data from the internet service providers in between, I might be able to take a system that can actually take all that data and actually tell you exactly where the problem is. It's just difficult to do it on one end because you have a limited perspective and you can't get the whole picture. It can tell you some specific issues or give you a guess at what the problem might be, but it's really that holistic perspective you need to understand where the problem lies. You might get lucky, and it could be actually the computer, and it could be very easy, like your firewall is not open, this is why the problem is there. Sometimes some computers will be able to do that, but I think right now they're always focusing on the applications that are most utilized by people. So it's a possibility, but there's also limitations, and that's kind of just the complexity of the general internet and the fact that if everything, for example, is owned by Microsoft, it might be a different story because things would be talking together in a little bit different way, and you might get different feedback that would allow for additional troubleshooting or additional machine intelligence to actually give you that feedback. So possible. I think there's improvements, but there's still a limit.
Yeah, there we go. Jeff, thanks. Interesting question. Appreciate it very much. Jim in Sun Prairie wonders if you think it makes sense to upgrade to an iPhone 10 from his 7. Why should he do that?
And I think the biggest reason to upgrade, especially for any kind of device, but probably especially for iPhones, really would be for support and speed. We actually had, I think, an iPhone 6, and it was a little bit sluggish on the latest software. Upgraded to an iPhone X, it's much more responsive. It's going to get support after a certain amount of time. The iPhone 7 is a little bit newer. I would look at, does it work for you now? Is there a support concern? What's the cost? Because if there's a significant cost to buy it, but there's not a whole lot of benefit, I'd probably wait until there's an iPhone 11. So if things are working now, I probably wouldn't look to upgrade right away. Many times, because there's usually an upgrade looming right around the corner anyway, and it's going to be a similar cost investment. And even at that point, even if you still wanted to upgrade to a 10, it might drop in cost. So if the phone works, I generally say keep it around unless you have support concerns, like you're not getting software upgrades, you can't install apps because it can't do what it needs to do, or you're lacking in storage. So, you know, I think for all of those, a 7 should be okay as long as it has all the things you need in a day-to-day basis. And I would wait until the point where you actually need to upgrade, just from a cost perspective. But everyone's a little bit different. Some people also like to just get the newer things that work better. But I would say it's probably fine to keep it around, because you're probably going to see another upgrade. You're going to get a, you know, a better cost benefit from it.
Basically, what I've done over time is I upgrade to one short of of the best when something comes out. And if I'm going to upgrade, then I'm going to get that upgrade for me for a third of the cost or whatever of the unit.
Yep.
And that's what I've done, and it seems to be working fine.
Yeah, it's kind of the idea of, too, of buying a brand new car or buying a used car, you know, how much the cost appreciates after a certain point. And, you know, there can be a benefit to getting something that it's actually still new. It's not like a used car, but you get a different benefit because the cost is so much lower.
Yeah. Jesse LeGru, our guest, technical team lead for the Division of Information Technology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your computer and your software today, talking a little bit about artificial intelligence as well with our guest, Jesse LeGru, technical team lead with the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technologies. Questions for Jesse, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Linda in Door County called to ask if you can recommend a good fitness app. And I've got MapMyRun is the one that I use just for jogging and running, and I like it a lot because that's what I do. And I think I got the free issue, and then I've upgraded for $1 to the little bit better issue a couple of years ago, and been running great for me.
Yeah, and there's a lot of them out there, and it always depends to, do you want to use extra hardware? What kind of device do you have now? And do you just want to track what you have? Because if you just want to track kind of how you exercise, whether it's running, lifting weights, anything, you can get good tracking applications that can do that for you. And I don't know if I have anything specific. I normally, for these, I actually look at whether I have an Android or an iPhone. I look at the ratings usually to see how widely it's used and what the ratings are to make the decisions, and kind of go with that. But it really is going to be based upon what kind of phone do you have. Are you okay with buying extra equipment? And because a lot of those will do the tracking for you. I have, for example, an Android phone that actually, without any extra software, can do heart rate monitoring. It can basically locate kind of where you are and know if you're being active and if you're moving distances, because it has GPS. So it can also give you, you move this far, you're generally running an average of this fast. If you're in a car, you can kind of cheat a little bit, but if it's got the heart rate thing, it should know you're actually doing something. And myself, I got a Fitbit to do that. And so I get data there. It collects my data. It does sleep patterns too, which actually, when looking at the fitness, is not a normal thing I would think about. But thinking about how your total day-to-day is actually shaped a lot by how you sleep, it's an important aspect outside of the activity that you have throughout the day. And there's a lot of different apps that'll do that, a lot of different hardware that will do that, including the phones themselves. So all those are considerations, and personally, I do like my Fitbit, but there's a lot of options out there. And first, I take a look to see what you'd like to use, and if you want to get extra hardware to do it. Personally, I like the things where I don't have to worry about collecting the data. It just collects it for me, and I don't have to take any action.
Yeah.
But if you don't want to do that, and you're doing things that you just literally want to record and look back. At that point, you could probably even use Excel or something else to record it, but it doesn't give you the analytics that are going to be really useful. And there's a lot of ones I would really look at your local, whether it's the App Store or the Google Play Store, and look at something that's generally well-used and highly rated. I use the Fitbit only because I just have the device, but that's capable for a variety of smartwatches or other kind of fitness trackers, and they have their own apps that could tie into other things, but then you're kind of, you know, you're funneled into the one product category.
Yeah. The Map My Run, I just kind of like it because I like to compare myself to the other 380,000 people who are using it. They always tell you where you rank. You know, if I'm in the top 5%, I'm feeling pretty good about myself for some reason. I don't know why, but I do feel good about that.
Well, and there's another one that I know, and I'm not sure. I think it's Strava, but there's a lot of different biking apps out there.
Yeah.
And I actually have a couple of friends that they bike a lot. And, you know, one, it's good for tracking. They get to find different trails that a lot of other people use. But you can actually have active competitions with people who may not even be there for different routes that you take and all this other interesting stuff. So you also kind of build a community around some of these applications where you can also just find other people like, oh, you know, to actually bike with or to do these other activities with. So there's just so many possibilities out there. But it can be geared exactly with what you do. So maybe your workout is, I like kayaking. Like that's the thing I do. There's probably an app for that. And there's probably a community around it that's actually tailored to it. So what you actually want to do on a day-to-day basis, I think is going to really guide what kind of application you're looking for. Because they'll tailor it very, very specifically to what you're doing.
Let's take another call. Pat in Franklin, thank you for calling.
Hi. My question deals with a software called Disney Circle. And it's basically, from what I understand, is it allows parents to control the amount of internet access, even time, on a child's phone or gaming system. But my real concern, and I've read the reviews, parents that have used it say that it's absolutely great, but there are some that say they've reported that there's a slowdown of their own usage on a computer. And I work 100% from home, and I'm on my computer for 8 hours a day. So I'm just wondering if there are some parental controls or software that you would recommend. Or is it a common, should I just get a different line, internet line for my son and a different router? I hope I'm giving you enough information.
Yeah, what do you think, Jesse?
Yeah, and in this case, do you have a computer that you use that's completely separate from your son's?
Correct.
Okay. In that case, at least from what I know from what I looked up about this specific application.
Disney Circle you're talking about.
Yeah, Disney Circle. It's computer specific. So if you don't install it on your computer, but install it on your son's computer, it really shouldn't affect your general internet unless you're both using the same computer. So I think it should be okay for kind of what you're using it for on a day-to-day basis. You'll only know over time. But I think it'd be okay in your current circumstance. I don't think there's a need to get a separate router, a separate internet connection, or anything like that. With that said, there's a lot of different parental control apps out there that I know NetNanny is one that's just been around for so long that has a really good customer base as well. Looking at some of the reviews, I mean, there's a variety of reasons to get one app versus another. Do you have any, is it just general internet access or time usage you're looking to?
Gaming?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, and he, my son is in his teen years and is kind of computer savvy. So I need one that, you know, it's not going to be, it's maybe more sophisticated so that he couldn't somehow override. And what I'm looking for is, okay, it's 10 o'clock, and at maybe 9:45, it goes, you know, something that would come up and say, your apps are, your phone is going to shut down, your computer is going to shut down, your Xbox is going to shut down, just to alleviate some of the arguments that go around or the pleading saying, can I stay on 5 minutes longer kind of thing. And I've heard of NetNanny before, and previously I installed it on a computer. I mean, this was a couple years ago, and it was like some of the settings, you know, you would say, I want to block things that are over 14. And it was a site that my son would go to. And when I looked at the site and I knew what he was using it for, I thought, okay, I'll let him use it. And it was kind of, and I don't know if it's changed, but it was like so, I hate to say this, but labor intensive. Like some sites, you couldn't, if you blocked everything or gave that description of 14 and over, it was everything 14 and over.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the challenge with a lot of the applications, is they do require a lot of oversight or a lot of training. And part of it's not actually the application's fault. A lot of the they kind of put the onus on the individuals that actually create the websites. So if things aren't done the same way with every single website on the internet, it can be very, very difficult to block one site versus another, to know whether one might be inappropriate and one is appropriate. So that's kind of the challenge. I don't think I have one that's going to be a silver bullet for all of it. I think a lot of it's challenging. One thing I'd consider, and do you have Windows-based devices? Is it does he have an iPhone? Does he have a Windows computer?
He's got an Xbox system. He's got an Android phone. So those all, you know, have Windows access, I would think. I'm not very computer. I mean, I work on a computer and.
Yeah, understood.
And for. Part of me would actually want to utilize the built-in tools that are in some of these. So the Xbox, I think, actually does have parental controls. So do a lot of the newer smart TVs do as well. And I know even my Android phone has the same, where you might be able to use the built-in tools in order to get around that, or at least to help control it using the built-in tools. One, because I think there's a lot of support for them. They help to update them. And generally, you know, a lot of other groups are using it, or a lot of other individuals out there. There are apps out there that can help that probably have to dig into a little bit more with research. One thing that I'm always thinking about is, you know, you kind of mentioned how to remove the likelihood that anyone's going to be able to get around it. There, if you're savvy enough, there's a way. There's a way to get around it. And I think that's something you might, that could be a focus for you to look at. And I don't have any off the top of my head, but applications that can actually notify you if, for example, they haven't checked in. So, you know, I can easily reset a phone and get around any control. But if you have an application installed that, you know, if you're using a device every day, it checks in every day. If it stops checking in, that's most likely a red flag. Well, it was reset. That's probably why this is not a known state, and it was probably gotten around. That could be something that might, that's probably a feature in many of these apps that you might want to look for if that's, you know, more of a concern versus just kind of filtering the content. It's kind of a balance in this case of, you know, what's the item you want to focus on the most, and there's no one silver bullet, and they do require a little bit of training. And I think the only thing I can recommend is definitely look at the reviews and comments from other users. And it's also very likely, if you look at your local school, they might actually have great resources themselves, because it's something that they probably notice on their own school networks, but can also help to get input from the community, since there's probably other parents that are concerned with similar things. So your local school might actually be another great resource.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Pat, thank you so much for calling. Glenn in West Allis says that he has a lot of problems with Windows 10 updates. Should he stop updating? Can he do that?
You can stop updating. I never recommend to stop updating your computer. If there are issues, there are some Microsoft websites that will actually help to do a check and try to resolve the issues for you. If you do continue to have issues, I would probably research the issues a little bit, but possibly take them to a computer store or a service facility to take a look. But I always recommend to continue to update your computer. It's also likely that there might just be one update out there one day that actually fixes the update issue. A lot of the updates that are released are not just security patches, but they're functional updates that actually fix an issue. And it could be that if you have an issue today, next month there's an update, that update is actually going to resolve your issue. So continue to update it. Look for a repair facility if possible, but I'd never recommend turning off your updates.
Yeah, and it's sort of the whole system, the way they use, the way they the companies go about this. They throw something out there without totally testing it, and then they wait for problems to develop, and then that's when they do the fixes.
Yep. Yeah, there's only so much you can test.
There is only so much you can test. Well, what about you? Do you have a computer issue that you would like to talk with Jesse LeGru about? I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Jesse, technical team lead at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technologies. We are going to take a quick break to take a look at the news, the weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Jesse. Again, the number 800-642-1234. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking with Jesse LeGru, technical team lead within the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technologies. Have you been having a problem with your computer or maybe your smartphone or your tablet? Jesse may have answers for you, so give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And just before, Larry and Delavan has a question for us. But before we get to that, just a reminder, join us Wednesday at 6 p.m. for Big River Radio Waves 4th of July special. There'll be music, storytelling, comedy with that special brand of Wisconsin wit. It's Big River Radio Wave Wednesday night, 6 p.m. on the Ideas Network. Let's turn our attention to Larry and Delavan now. Larry, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry, Jesse. Thank you for taking my call. It's really rather trivial, but I've got a Samsung tablet, and a lot of times if I log in on the internet, and it goes to MSN typically, and I'll be looking at some of the different news feeds, and every time it goes to that, I get the message, couldn't establish a secure connection. I can click OK, and then I can go ahead. It'll take me to the article, and then it'll pop that message up again. I can click OK, and I can read the article. I finish reading that article. I'll go back to another article. I'll get the same, couldn't establish a secure connection. And I'm at home out in the country, so it's not like I anticipate them being hacked. So I don't know if there's something I could do about that or just totally ignore it. It's just annoying.
What kind of Samsung tablet do you have?
It's a Samsung Note, the 8.
Okay.
It's an older one.
Yeah, the one of the original things I was kind of thinking of, there's a variety of reasons you can get this message. Usually it's because you're trying to access a secure website, and for whatever reason you can't get to it. A lot of the security protocols, they change over time and they get upgraded. Older devices that may not be able to be patched might have challenges with some newer secured websites. It's a possibility. It's nothing you can actually get around unless you can install from the Google Play Store an updated third-party application. Are you using the built-in browser that came with it?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I would consider downloading, if you're still able to access the Play Store, trying to download any updated third-party application, such as Firefox. Google Chrome most likely comes as a separate application on an older Android device. And trying those, because it might actually give you a better experience because you're actually having an updated application. It sounds like it's intermittent, and it's only when you access certain websites. So to me, it actually feels like it's potentially an incompatibility with a website in your device. And I think that might just be because of the age of the device. So I download a third-party app, see if you get the same message. If you're able to download a third-party app and you get the same message, at least it tells you it's not the browser. And so it's a different troubleshooting from that case. But I have a feeling that using a different updated third-party browser is going to resolve your issue. Have you tried at any other location to see if you still get the same message?
No, it's like I've got Flipboard on here, and I can go to Flipboard and I don't get that message. But you know, with the NSN, it's typically the one, and yet I can go to all of the news articles and the news feed. It's just I get the message that keeps popping up each time before it opens the news feed.
Yep.
Yeah, I would try getting a third-party application and going from there.
Yeah, makes good sense. Thanks, Larry. Appreciate it. Dave in Evansville, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having the show.
Sure.
Just have a quick question related to something popped up on my computer. It said, don't turn your computer off. You've had a virus or something in your computer. Call this phone number. And my wife called the number, and it was somebody that was saying they had a security system that they needed to install on the system, that ours wasn't working correctly, and that they worked with Microsoft and all this kind of stuff, and I assumed it was a scam. But I'm just curious if this is a normal type scam that is going around that just should ignore it.
Yep.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is normal, and it's a normal scam. It's something that happens relatively frequently. I've had it happen to a couple people that I know. If normally they will ask for credit card information or other payment details to pay for services to help resolve any security issues with your computer. If for whatever reason you did do that, I would recommend contacting your bank, just give them the details so that they can hopefully establish a refund. But in this case, it is, I'll say 99.9%, it's going to be a scam. Most of the time, that's not going to be something where you're going to have a magical phone number to call somebody to resolve an issue. A lot of times it happens with people who are trying to basically scam people to pay for services that they essentially created the problem for in the first place. So they are really trying to, you know, make some money in this case.
There you go, Dave. Stay away from it. Let's go to Mary in Clintonville. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. Actually, now good afternoon. I have a question about the new appliances, like mainly the refrigerators that have the internet access. I have been told that those are not secure and that it can possibly leave open your home internet network being hacked. Is there any possibility of that?
And possibility here, I'll say with anything you connect to a network, there's always a possibility. The actual danger of it, I think, will depend on the device that you use. But any kind of device you have connected to the internet that especially accesses cloud resources or is managed by a vendor. So, for example, if I had refrigerator manufacturer and they had an app installed and it contacted them so they could, you know, track usage and give you updates on your phone. There's a likelihood that at any point within that communication, even the vendor themselves, that they could get into the network and do something bad. So it's always a risk. And technically, that's a possibility, and that's why a lot of high security systems, they don't want to have any internet access, because you remove that capability. So it's a possibility. I think it's usually going to be a smaller, not a smaller chance, but the the more specific the device, the less likely it can be used or will be used as an attack vector. So my Windows computer has a lot of capabilities, and people would rather use my Windows computer to hack into a network than to use a refrigerator, just because of the fact the refrigerator has limited capabilities in that case. So it's a possibility. I think it's a lower one. There are a lot of different ways to try to protect against that, and I think routers that really kind of funnel all of your internet at home can be one of those protective barriers. But even then, you know, a lot of those are, you know, fairly expensive with all these advanced protection modules. So long answer, it's possible. I think it's a lower risk than the actual computers you have that you're using on a day-to-day basis, however.
There you go, Mary. Thank you for calling. And turning next to Rick in Nakusa. Hi, Rick.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind, Rick?
I've got a desk model, and I've got a hesitation. When I, at any time, I'm keying, and all of a sudden, the cursor stops, and it will not accept any more keying input of letters. So I can wait sometimes 5 seconds, sometimes it's 15 seconds before I'm allowed to key some more. It'll happen, maybe 5 to 10 times a day.
Yeah, and sometimes if you keep typing, you won't see it, but then it'll appear after the fact. Is that the case?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you usually have that behavior happen in the same application or any application that you're using?
Any application.
The first thing I'd probably do, usually in this case, basically the computer's doing something. It's kind of working hard doing whatever it's doing in the background, and you're basically the things you're typing are just being queued to be replayed later by the computer. It's possible it could be a hardware defect. But it's also possible that there might actually be malware or something else in your computer that's actually slowing your computer down. I would say in this case, it's something slowing down your computer. It could be updates for an application. It could be the applications themselves and that they're doing something that's just not proper in the background. I would actually download a malware program, an anti-malware program, that can scan your computer and remove anything hopefully running in the background to make it run a little bit smoother. And there's a lot of free ones out there. If you Google them, Super Anti-Spyware is one that I've used quite a bit, SpyBot Search and Destroy. There's a lot of applications to take a look at. I would download one, run it, see what happens, and do a restart. But it does feel like there's something running in the background that's really taking all your compute power, and that's causing that delay. The thing now is just to find out what's doing it, get rid of it, and then hopefully it's going to resolve things in the future. But you can always take it to a computer repair location, and they should be able to assist as well.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. There's a book out, best-selling book out now by Bill Clinton, former President Clinton, and James Patterson. It's called The President Is Missing. I just finished reading it, and it essentially it's about some nefarious people who managed to put something into our computer system that would turn off all computer functions in the country. And, it's a little... It may be quite far-fetched. It may not be. I don't know. But just the discussion of what would happen in this country if you suddenly were without the ability to use a computer and everything was erased from your former computer, everything from bank records to Social Security to... all the day-to-day things that we rely on computers for. I found that part of the book pretty fascinating. It wasn't the greatest book in the world, but certainly made me think about vulnerability that we could have from somebody who wanted to, you could pretty much destroy the country if you were able to do that.
Yeah, it would be...
hospital, everything.
It'd be a massive, well, it would affect everything massively. The things, even on a day-to-day basis that we do right now, especially with a lot of phone systems, we're going from away from what we called POTS or plain old telephone service to VoIP technology, so voice over IP. We might be utilizing that on a cell phone, on a laptop, on an actual device on our desk, but those are all computer-driven. And even some of the switching systems that we use for telephones, some of those might be updated and they might be computerized. So communications would be devastated. That's just one thing. So just being able to talk to somebody else would completely change. For some people, it probably wouldn't affect them too much. But for a lot of individuals that communicate with people, even throughout the same city in a different way, would be completely isolated, not to mention just even all of the government services that we utilize on a day-to-day basis that might be computerized or computers might be utilized to understand routes. And I was even thinking about, my garbage and recycling was taken this morning. How much of that is computerized and how much is not? How do people know what routes they do? How do they know their shift schedules? All these little things. And it would be devastating. My day-to-day, I work with computers. So, I guess I could sit around for a while, but, what does that mean for a day-to-day for somebody that actually works on a computer? But even the other services that we utilize that require computer records, it would be devastating.
Anybody retired getting a government check, you wouldn't be able to prove that you were part of that system. I mean, it's a fascinating book from that perspective, for sure, and kind of scary.
Yeah, and that's always where the backup of data is probably the most important. Assuming everything just went away, having backups is crucial. We have a lot of paper records that we have as backups, but I think also having computer backups is one of the biggest struggles, challenges. If we have that, we can always rebuild. But
yeah.
If those backups get removed, that's a completely different scenario.
This thing removed the backups, too.
Yep.
So.
And in this case, this is where it's always important to have offline backups. So it's not connected to a computer network. It's in a different geographical area. There's all these pieces to try to mitigate those circumstances. But if everything was online, that's a huge, huge thing. If we had to go back, we'd be recreating paper records. We've been digitizing so many paper records for such a long time. To go back to that would be a huge task.
Well, let's go to Duane in Milwaukee. Hi, Duane. What's on your mind?
Hi, fellas. I have sort of an embarrassing admission that I have 40,000 emails on my Gmail account. And I would, my daughter mocks me mercilessly for this. She'll have like six. But what I'd like to do is not have to go through each and every one to discard them. I would just like to wipe that whole platter clean and start fresh with my account. Is there a way to do this?
And there are a couple ways to do this. If you did just want to delete all of your emails, that's something you could do from... I think you can actually do that from the Gmail settings, where you can actually just clear out your inbox. One of the other things that you could utilize, and it depends on how you check your Gmail on a day-to-day basis, but they have a lot of kind of self-sort functions where you don't necessarily look at your inbox. You're looking at different categories that Gmail kind of does. And by the way, I wouldn't feel too bad. A lot of us have email. I am guilty of being a pack rat, so I tend to have a lot of email in my inbox, and I just kind of go through it on a day-to-day basis. But if you did just want to, hit Control-A, select all, and delete, you could do that from Gmail. And let me actually see if... There are a few different ways to do this in different email clients. Are you using the Gmail web interface?
Yeah, on a Mac.
Okay. For a lot of these, if I take a look, and I can't easily just hit select all and delete, you could do it a couple of different ways. One, if you wanted to start off completely fresh, you could actually create a new email address and then just deactivate the old one, meaning you'd start off really clean. It also means you wouldn't be getting a lot of junk mail into your inbox if that were the case as well. Sometimes it's nice to actually start off clean just to remove any kind of junk. But you could also go to the Gmail settings and try to clear out your inbox. I'm not finding a really easy one right now, but a lot of the Gmail tools generally allow you to export all your data, including Google Drive, really easily. I think they would allow you to clean out your inbox as well. I'm just not finding it right away, but there should be a good method nearly in your inbox. There's an upper left-hand side where you can hit select all and then just hit delete.
It's pretty much, it'll take a while to delete that many. But I was guilty of that, too. I had about 20,000 or something at one point. My computer was slowing down, and I went ahead and deleted everything, and it made a big difference.
Yeah, the other thing, if for whatever reason it's not actually in the built-in web tool, you could set up a separate email client, like Outlook, Outlook Express, or any kind of desktop client to actually connect to your email. And those graphical interfaces will actually display 40,000 messages where you can hit select all and hit delete. So it could be another way to work around it.
There's a
few different ways to do it. That's an option if there is not a built-in tool for Gmail.
Ben emailed to say his camera in his Surface Pro 3 tells him that an app needs permission for the camera to be in use. He can't use his camera or find an app that needs his permission to use the camera. He's reset the camera and looked at the apps without success. No Facebook or Twitter on his machine. Any thoughts on how to get his camera back?
What I'd probably do first is I'd actually go to the Windows settings because it has a camera and other kind of devices, so like cameras, printers, and scanners. I would go there because it does have a view of your camera so you can see it. Go there to see if you're actually able to get a camera feed and see if that's what's prompting to allow or deny. Most likely, the camera works itself, and it could be the Windows system that's actually trying to access the camera, and unless you hit allow, it won't actually go through. It's one of those items where, you know, you're kind of scared to hit allow because you don't know what you're allowing, but take a look at the Windows device settings.
And somebody else was wondering how to prevent credit card theft online.
There's a variety of ways. One is just general protection of your own credit cards, not having them laying around. Don't type them in anywhere. Don't send them via email. So just make sure that the only way to get your credit card number is by the card you actually hold on your person. Another way is to actually utilize, which a lot of this is free generally, but any kind of credit monitoring service. Many times your bank will already have one that is kind of generally turned on, and they'll alert you if they notice any issues, which once again, machine learning is a huge part of that for fraud prevention. But have fraud prevention services, but make sure just to store your credit card in a secure location. I wouldn't even put it in a password manager application. I would just make sure it's only on that physical card.
That makes a lot of sense. And you know what? Here we are out of time. My goodness, the time has flown by. Jesse, I want to thank you so much for being with us. And you'll be back in September, and we will do this all over again. Jesse, thanks a lot. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Jesse LeGru, technical team lead within the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Great to have him with us. And he'll be back in September. We'll do it all over again. Tomorrow at this time, wildlife expert Scott Craven back with us. He's a day early. Normally comes on the first Wednesday, but because of the July 4th holiday, he's coming in a day early. So he'll be on tomorrow on the show, and that'll be at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.